From the Sky News Centre at 6, Donald Trump wants the US Attorney General to investigate the New York Times over a column apparently written by an anonymous member of his team. The piece claims the author is part of a White House resistance which is working to frustrate the president's agenda. It calls Mr. Trump erratic. Our senior correspondent Ian Woods is in Washington.
It's not altogether clear what crime has been committed. Donald Trump might think it is treason, but other people might think that is just freedom of speech protected by the First Amendment. Was any classified information revealed in that article? Hard to see what classified information could be defined in that.
British Airways could be fined £500 million after the personal and financial details of around 380,000 customers were stolen in a hack. It might end up with a fine of either £17 million or 4% of its global turnover, whichever is greater. Daniel Prince is a cyber security professor.
It doesn't look like it's a wholesale data extraction from their systems. It looks like one of the intermediary systems has been compromised and that's provided the data leak. 15 days is actually quite a fast turnaround from detection to remediation.
A 16-year-old has been sentenced to 4 years behind bars after killing a shopkeeper who refused to sell him cigarette papers. Vijay Kumar Patel had catastrophic head injuries after the attack in North London in January. The Lib Dem leader, Sir Vince Cable, says he plans to resign after Brexit. Before then, he wants to open up the party to disaffected Labour and Conservative members and MPs. Makers of Jet hand dryers say proper hand washing solves the problem of germs being spread by drying. The University of Leeds found levels of bacteria in toilets was far higher when the machines were being used instead of paper towels. In sport, England's cricketers have suffered a major collapse on day one of the fifth test against India. Moeen Ali's just been caught for 50, and a short time ago, England were 181 for 7 at the Oval. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to The Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Glastonbury and Street, Liz Leishan, and Mayor Ferguson's finance chief, Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's, Jeff Gollop. Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Swedish elections on Sunday after a raft of attacks and street fighting, supposedly by migrants across the country. Will the anti-immigration Swedish Democrat Party romp home as a result? And in the Middle East, in Syria, Idlib, what could be the final assault when the Syria war has begun? What are the most likely outcomes after Aleppo, Ghouta, Mosul and other cities which have been liberated from the terrorists? Will there be a pretext for the US to intervene? But hang on, there are American troops in Syria anyway. Probably British too, so what are they up to? And what will Israel's role be? Will the terrorists succeed in their aim of getting as many of their civilian human shields in Idlib killed as possible? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take on a tour of other hotspots around the world in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, clear skies. This weekend, 17 or 18 degree temperatures. Tomorrow, cloudy with some rain later in the afternoon. And sunny periods on Sunday, possibly showers or a shower or two later. Next week, mostly dry except midweek, a little rain. Sunny towards the end of next week. And next weekend, the 15th and 16th of September, warm. That is around 18 Celsius. And a dry, sunny weekend, mostly dry, into the middle of September and plenty of sun. That was Bristol's two-weekend plus-a-bits weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Glastonbury and Street, Liz Leishan. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you.
It's a way for you to come. Thank you so much for coming up to see us, because there's many people, even nationally, have got eyes at the moment on Somerset, haven't they? Particularly at the county council, as another council which may run out of money. Anyway, so as one of the opposition people, explain first of all what your role is and then what your prospects are for Somerset staying solvent.
Okay, I'm the opposition spokesperson for resources. Resources is another word for money and people and things. So that's what I'm doing now. You can imagine, as a fairly new councillor, I was only voted in last May, and before that I was in the workforce, actually working for local authority for a long time, and then in the arts.
Doing what in the workforce?
Well, I was, oddly enough, running a theatre and cinema, and that was part of a further education college. So I was employed by the county council until 93, when colleges went through incorporation. Came out of the county council, which I have to say was a kind of liberation, because we could raise money from other sources and actually get things done without having to have triplicate carbon copies of everything. And so I left the county at that point. I stayed in the pension scheme, though. There was still county council and district council funding for the arts until 2011, when the Tory administration in both Mendip and county said no more arts funding and took it away overnight. 100% cut overnight. So when we're talking about people feeling pain in Somerset, I know what it feels like.
What do you put that down to?
It's a lot of factors. Nobody could say it's just one factor. The big factor is the national picture for the top tier local authorities, the ones that have the statutory requirements to look after children and young people and adult social care. There's no question about that. That is hugely onerous. The demand is growing. Government cuts have fallen off the government grants have fallen off a cliff. They've lost £90 million in the last few years. They've cut £130 million from the county council expenditure. They've done all they can, but the whole situation in Somerset, and this may be one of the defining factors, is that they froze council tax for 7 years. The first 2 years they got a grant from the government equivalent to 1%, so nobody would suggest that any colour of administration would have put up council tax those 2 years. But from then on, they stayed in with what the government was supposedly asking them to do, no council tax increase. That's meant if you add it all up and you take the Bandy House, the usual calculations, if they'd gone back in when other people went back in, they'd have had over another 29 million in the base budget. If you total all of the years, it would have been over £100 million of expenditure over those years, but it would be at the most £29 million in the base budget every year. Now, so they're fighting a losing battle at the moment.
Well, look, you're part of the Lib Dems.
Yeah.
Then that they, along with the Conservatives, imposed this whole austerity budget after 2008, didn't they?
Yep, that's absolutely correct, and I'm not one who would sit there and deny any part in that. One of my fellow county councillors was an MP then, Tessa Munt, so I know exactly what the picture was then. I don't believe that any colour county council probably would have put up the council tax for 4 years, but I think after the Tories got back in 2013, that's when they should have looked again, and they should have looked further ahead at that stage, I believe.
How long is Somerset County Council going to last at the moment, though? Because I was quite concerned to read that the second down on the list from Northampton as a potential county to go bankrupt, and also the only other county in the country apparently with as few reserves, or next to as few reserves, as Northampton.
That's correct, and that's when we were working on what we were being told of £20 million of usable reserves, and now we're being told, actually, now that we have a new finance director and he's worked through all what they call the negative earmarked reserves and he's cleared the decks, and he says actually the usable reserves are £7.8 million, which is less than the savings they're looking to make in year this year now. Put that to any businessman and see what they have to say about that.
Well, no, I'm going to put it to Jeff, actually. Jeff Gollop, you were involved intimately with the finance of the city, in the last administration, Jeff, with Mayor Ferguson. First of all, tell us about what your role was then, and then secondly, what do you make of having £3 or 4 million in reserves?
Well, under George Ferguson's administration, I had responsibility for finance and budget management. Now, interestingly, we took the view that in spite of the incentives to freeze the council tax, we put forward by a Conservative government, we recognised that those were only going to come back and hit us very quickly, and therefore we took the view that we had to maintain an increase in the council tax.
Do you think some politicians think, well, we can get away with this for a few years, by which time we won't actually be sitting here anymore, someone else will have to deal with it?
No, I don't actually think. I'm not as cynical as you, Tony. I don't think that, but I don't think they. I don't think people understand the consequences. And we see, in all sorts of ways, we see short-term decisions, and that means that we're looking at savings now. And those savings now, in all sorts of services, if you cut the money you're spending or the way you're looking after the most needy and troubled families, for example, now, you will undoubtedly have more costs in 2, 3, 5, 7 years' time because of the demands that will be created. So it's very short-sighted. There is a funding issue for local government. Whether it's the big shire counties or whether it is the unitary authorities like Bristol, we are at a level where funding is now is very tight, and whereas there was surplus to cut back in the past through inefficiency, you can only have so many change programmes before you run out of efficiencies that you can reproduce, and then you end up cutting frontline services, and that's not acceptable.
I'm going to put the same question to you, though, as I did to Liz. Your gurus, George Osborne, David Cameron, this is their policy, austerity. Were they unwise? Are you no longer worshipping at the altar of George Osborne?
I'm not sure I ever worshipped at the altar of George Osborne, but actually, austerity sadly had to happen, and I'll tell you the one reason why it had to happen. If the national economy had, if there had been confidence lost in the UK economy and sterling, interest rates would have had to rise, and what you would have then had is higher taxes, higher interest rates, and still no money to spend on services. So actually, there was a need to put the national finances in order.
Well, I've got news for you. But there's also a need. Interest rates have started to rise now, haven't they, Jeff? And we've got a bit of lack of confidence due to Brexit.
But there is also a need to ensure that there is sufficient funding for the services that are needed, that are statutory, and do affect those who are most disadvantaged. And we are very close to that tipping point now.
What about reserves? How's Bristol City Council off compared to £3 or 4 million down in Somerset?
What? Reserves is one of those interesting battlegrounds. Government ministers talk about reserves as though there are bundles of cash sat there waiting to be used. It will. In fact, most authorities have money that is earmarked for things that are already committed. I must admit, I have not come across negative earmarked reserves. That is a new one on me. And probably highlights why some authorities have more significant financial pressures. So there aren't vast amounts of money sat there to be utilised. And to be honest, you need to look in terms of the budgets of most of these authorities and say, well, what's a reasonable sum of money to have to provide? Bristol had the first 3 months monitor presented to Cabinet on Tuesday after the arena discussion, and that shows massive overspends on adult care. Real pressures that are going to have to be addressed in the course of the year. And part of the difficulty is that we can use austerity as a, well, we've got a threat, the funding's reduced and so on. But actually, that budget was set in February, and 3 months into the financial year, we're massively overspending it. That's not acceptable in any circumstances. There might be a good reason for it, but we should be able to forecast that reason, and we should be able to get our budgeting accurate at the start of the financial year.
It sounds to me like you're saying our budget here in Bristol isn't actually realistic. It's a bit of a wishful thinking budget.
That's certainly what it would appear to be, and there is no excuse for that level of variance 3 months on, and unless it's demand pressure. And if it's demand pressure, we should be clearly able to point to that fact and not actually just say, well, we got an overspend.
Well, look, Jeff, you know your pounds, shillings and pence. What about policies to do something about this? Because the national debt is now 1.6, 1.7 trillion. Mm-hmm. It's been going up and up, skyrocketing ever since this austerity programme came in 2010. Clearly, we're not doing anything to clear the national debt. So it doesn't seem to be a lot of point in cutting off our nose to spite our face. What would be your prognosis if you were sitting in Philip Hammond's shoes saying, really, we're going to have to deal with this and this is how I'd do it?
Well, I'm going to revert to a Labour councillor, Helen Holland's comment at Cabinet, where she was quoting social services minister, whose comment is unless there are additional funding for local authority social services equivalent to the money that's gone into the extra money that's gone into the health service, we will not succeed. And I think the comparison was really like running water into a bath but without a plug-in, because there's no point in spending more money on the health service if we don't have the care services for those who are discharged from hospital to look after them and help them recover.
So, but I'm getting, can I come back to my question, which was about...
It's about funding.
It's also about, I suppose, macroeconomic policy. It's about what you do with the Bank of England, how you use the British government's shareholdings in some of the major banks, which they still hold, whether it makes any sense to be printing money, quantitative easing, and then putting that into banks. I was looking at some figures last weekend. It's as 80 billion a year going into the banks through QE and 20 billion mm-hmm. a year going into the stock exchange and big businesses. Mm-hmm. But we as ordinary people are seeing none of that QE. If you're going to make money up, surely it makes sense for some of it to go to the poorer half of society who are much more likely to spend it rather than squirrel it away somewhere in a tax haven.
No, absolutely. I agree with you totally. It is being directed in the wrong way. And that is the issue that is very much threatening the services that we provide.
So what can you as a Conservative do about that, being in the party that's in government?
All we can do is express our views to government ministers whenever we have the opportunity to do so.
Well, you'll have that opportunity on Sunday the 30th of September to Wednesday the 3rd of October. That's at the International Convention Centre in Birmingham. I think you know what I'm talking about. Are you going to be up there at the Conservative conference?
No.
No? But no. That's your chance to I suppose, pat a few on the back and maybe to gently twist a few arms.
It doesn't work like that these days. That's a chance for us to be told what we're thinking, and I'm quite happy knowing what I'm thinking, and I don't need to be reminded.
Look, before we hear from Liz from the Lib Dems, Somerset County Council, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'm sure you have got a more Varoufakis-like statement to make about the way things are financially. I mean, we don't want to lose local authorities, we don't want them going bankrupt. We don't want the services that they provide, such as things like basic things like toilets, libraries to go, all the other things we were hearing from Liz earlier about running theatres, this kind of thing, local theatres, those things to go, which they have done. And it now looks as if the whole thing is being pared down to the bone, literally, and scraping the barrel when it comes to cuts. So what would you do from a Philip Hammond level and from a macroeconomic level? I think we ought to set Brexit aside for one moment, because at least we do have some control in this country over the pound and over money. And what would you be doing if you were in Philip Hammond's shoes to start steering some of this QE, as I was saying, there 100 billion last year, towards a more profitable and more useful end?
Well, first of all, I'd like to pick up on the need for austerity. When Nick Clegg had just been elected and become Deputy Prime Minister, I interviewed him for this programme, if you remember, and I pointed out that the kind of austerity they were going to pursue was too far, too fast, and it would lead to the country losing its AAA credit rating. He didn't understand the question, quite obviously, and then not that very long afterwards, the country did lose its AAA credit rating. So, in other words, the whole policy is to try and keep the country's creditworthiness, as Jeff said earlier, but you lost the AAA credit rating. I would account that pretty incompetent by any definition, and it's both Liberal and Conservative parties were responsible for that debacle, although it wasn't really picked up in the mainstream press and most people don't really understand what happened.
Come on,
even the Labour Party didn't make
much. Martin, would you do?
Well, what you do is first of all, you don't cut too far too fast. The second thing you do, a QE is only supposed to be a stopgap measure. What you then do is you move towards a planned economy, frankly, and of course there was no real demand for that at the time and most people didn't understand the necessity for it. I think after the next crash, which is coming down the pike, people will be more prepared to think more radically about what needs to be done. And of course, you can't cut your way out of a depression. There will have to be investment, and that will mean raising taxes on some people.
I mean, is QE a disaster, Martin? Is QE a disaster?
No, it is a potential disaster. I agree with the Austrian school economists about this, the von Mises Institute. The point about something like that is it's supposed to be a stopgap measure. It's not supposed to become a permanent policy. And we've now led to a situation we've got massive asset bubbles across the board, across the industrialised world, which are going to collapse and then create major problems for not just for governments but for people. And of course, the other thing about this is that the council tax itself is an incredibly regressive tax. In Northern Ireland, they've still got the rates because the poll tax, they didn't dare to introduce it because of the consequences. And of course, they're better funded as a result.
All right, Martin. Liz, we've heard a few arguments from Jeff and Martin there. What are your thoughts if you were in the top chairs deciding this? Because at the moment, it looks to me as if local government is going. It's slowly going. What the people are who are only people going to be left are the likes of Amazon. Yeah. And these companies that are very clever at hiding where their money is, so they don't have to pay any tax.
I know.
And of course, the super rich. So, what was your?
Well, I think basically as a country, not everywhere, but in a lot of places, I think we're undertaxed, and that's Lib Dem policy to increase income tax for the National Health Service. In a minute, you know what they'll be saying. They'll be saying that local authority needs some too. And there is some movement towards putting a children and families precept in the way they have an adult social care precept, in order to get round being able to put up council tax without having to call a referendum or whatever. So instead of going up 6% or 10%, you go up 2 here, 2 there, 1.9 here, and actually the whole package will send it up.
The problem
way
is national centrally, isn't it? I mean, that's the real problem. Is in London, actually. It's in Westminster. It's easy for us around the country to say that. But what is happening is they are gathering less tax and they are giving less out to the regions. And they're saying to the regions, oh, well, you're going to have to tax your own people.
But last week, we were on holiday in West Somerset and somebody just up the road from us was a serious National Health Service man. When you're on holiday in your shorts and T-shirts, it doesn't matter where you work, does it? You still got to fetch your kids off the beach the same. And he was speaking and he said to me, I don't know why you keep thinking about this as a local issue. This is a national agenda to cut the reliance on the state. And they're doing it by breaking down the National Health Service, and they're doing it by breaking the local authorities to cut the reliance on the state. And I thought, crikey, that's different from the way I've been thinking. I'm very parochial. Of course I am. I'm not a national economist. I'm a local councillor dealing with issues of double yellow lines and parking places and speed limits and all that sort of stuff, getting help for people when they come out of hospital. Nobody voted for me as a national economist, and as far as I know, Somerset County Council hasn't got any economists on its cabinet.
Well, that may contribute to one of the reasons why they go broke. Who knows? Martin, if governments are becoming weakened, becoming more impoverished, who is now taking their place?
Well, it's always been the case that there are power centres outside the elected government. I mean, the City of London has always been a very, very powerful force in British politics behind the scenes. And they basically dictate the agenda. especially since the Big Bang in the 80s and so on. So, and of course, they're getting more. When a country gets into international debt like Greece, it becomes completely at the mercy of powerful forces that they can't control.
That's true, isn't it, Jeff? If we're in debt and we need money, then we simply have to do whatever the banks tell us to.
It's always thus, whether you're a small business, a big business, or a country. And, you know, perhaps the most worrying thing is when you say that, the one in probably the biggest debt is the United States of America. And that has potential implications for all of us.
We seem to be almost copying their policy, don't we, by sort of not worrying about the national debt and hoping it will go away.
Well, when you talk about economics and economists, I don't necessarily believe, and having studied economics myself, I can be critical of economists. I don't necessarily believe economists are going to be the solution to problems, and indeed they may be the cause of problems. And I think that we can make life too complicated. And actually, what we need to understand is at each level, we have to be viable. Go back to that small business. A small business has a certain amount of income. It can't spend more than that income. And actually, that is the case for a local authority. It's the case for public companies. And there's a danger. We make life too complicated and we distort. Talking about quantitative easing, that totally distorts the economy in all sorts of ways. And Martin's right. It's a short-term fix to support and encourage. But if you keep it going so that even when you see a recession looming, you're still operating it from the last time you had a recession, you've definitely got a serious problem.
That's a good point, and that seems to be what's happening, Martin. Is it true to say that capitalism is no longer happening? It died in 2008? Well, because if you're going to allow these big banks who are massively in debt, begging to the government, saying, look, unless you bail us out, there's going to be no money tomorrow, and then they're bailed out, that isn't actually capitalism, is it? If you bail out someone who's failed, then what you're doing is you're actually reinforcing that failure.
Well, that's what the von Mises Institute would argue, and the Austrian School economists, and of course the case, they say, well, it's only a one-off, and the problem is they keep coming back for more. So if you've got a failing steel industry, you could end up propping it up when it's not really viable in international terms. But I think when you're talking about the international banking system, it's a way above a national steel industry. And I think Jeff mentioned the US national debt there. It's increasing as the trade deficit increases, and that's what causes the trade deficit in the US. So Trump's trade war is actually not doing anything to improve the trade deficit, because he's increasing the budget deficit. And of course the US can do that because they print the world's reserve currency, and now that you've got quantitative tightening in the Federal Reserve, that's caused an emerging markets crisis in Turkey, Argentina, Brazil. That means just turning down the amount of quantitative easing. It doesn't mean you've stopped quantitative easing, it just means you've turned, because people have got addicted to heroin. All of the private companies in Turkey have borrowed money in dollars, which they've now got to repay in depreciated lira, which they can't do. And it's the private sector that's going to topple over the Turkish economy. And that's because you've created this basically market distortion of quantitative easing, which of course I don't believe in quantitative easing as a way of trying to solve capitalism's problems. It won't. It's going to cause a bigger crash than 2008, and then of course we'll really start talking about, you can't just run things on debt, but the national economy doesn't function like a private business. It just doesn't. And I recognise that you can't run everything on debt, which means of course you have to redistribute. Once you've done quantitative easing and created asset price bubbles, the wealth that's been generated has not been generated because people have done anything constructive for the economy. They've just basically benefited, and therefore that money is absolutely legitimate to be taken off those people. You don't have to argue about it. They shouldn't have it. It should be taken off them. It should be used for something sensible.
So why has Mark Carney been giving them this money then?
Because the alternative is to actually allow the economy to crash, Tony, and nobody really wanted that. But of course the idea was that you'd reach some kind of escape velocity of economic economic growth, which would then allow you to solve the problem. And of course, what's happened is we have a massive increase in asset prices, very weak economic growth, and we're about to have the crash associated with all of that, and then the government finances will be even further deteriorated.
In which case, it might be that the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's decision this week not to put public money into the Bristol Arena and to cancel the project in the Temple Island, I guess it's called. I'm not sure exactly what it's called, Jeff. I mean, this was pretty well trial beforehand. I suppose the main criticism of Marvin is the way that he's done the whole thing very much behind closed doors. But anyway, what do you think of the decision to cancel the Temple Meads Arena this week?
I think it's a devastating decision. I think it's a very serious one for Bristol. I think it indicates that the centre of Bristol will effectively shift to the North Bristol fringe and the South Gloucestershire border, and I believe it means that there will be serious pressures on jobs and businesses in the city centre, because future investment will be directed to Filton and Cribbs Causeway and not to Broadmead and Cabot Circus.
But I mean, this is public land. What about Marvin's argument that, look, we just can't justify spending this vast amount of public money on something like this, which isn't part of the City Council's essential services, isn't even maybe available to the poorest quarter, poorest third of people living in the city?
I think there are some real concerns about the way this whole thing's been dealt with. I chaired the council's scrutiny committee that met for 10 hours. We met the potential operator, we met the potential contractor. We discovered that actually they had had no communication from the mayor or his office in terms of trying to negotiate a better deal. So actually the costs of that arena could have been reduced significantly had those discussions taken place. What we actually have, though, is an even stranger situation, because the mayor claims that there's no public money to be spent, excepting that the money that was going to be spent on the arena in Temple Island is actually going to have to be spent to enhance the traffic arrangements around the Brabazon Hangar at Filton. YTR will then build the arena at no cost to the authority, but the authority will have to put in all the transport arrangements, and the transport arrangements will significantly increase the value of YTL's land at Filton, significantly more than the cost of YTL building the arena. So we go from a situation where the local authority is borrowing the money to fund a development in Bristol to one where we're borrowing money to fund transport improvements to add value to a Malaysian company.
Well, now, early this week, there was an extraordinary meeting at the City Council about this, Jeff. Can you just tell us about the circumstances surrounding that? It's not often we have such a meeting. Why was it called?
No. So a group of councillors from the three opposition parties initially, but also including a number of Labour councillors, so from all four parties, called this meeting. And it was called so that members of council could express their opinion before the mayor made his decision on the following day. Now, very confusingly, the mayor and the whole of the Labour Party voted in favour of the arena being built at Temple Meads on Monday, even though the mayor explained when he did so that he would be choosing to not build it there on Tuesday. Now, I am sure he used some very clever words, and I'm sure that all that stacks up, but I'm just an ordinary guy, and when someone votes one way on a Monday and votes the opposite way on a Tuesday when they actually make the decision, I believe that is treacherous behaviour. That is not doing what people want to see. And I've been astounded by the response that I've had from my comments over the last week. The fact is, an arena at Filton is an arena for people from South Gloucestershire and a little bit of North Bristol. Bizarrely, and it's been explained to me by a senior Labour councillor, that even if a railway station is put in it, the arena at Filton, the lack of availability of rolling stock means that there will be a quarter hour or half hourly service of a three carriage train from Filton to Temple Meads after an event, which means the first two trains might arrive at Temple Meads while mainline train services are operating.
It'll be like India. People will be hanging off the side of the train.
Exactly. So what it means, and I can't help this, I represent an area in North Bristol, so I have my residents have a vested interest. But the belief is that up to 80% of people going to an arena at Temple Meads would come by public transport by one means or another. If it's at Filton, up to 80 or even 90% will go by car, and those people will drive through my ward and other wards in North Bristol. They will park on the roads in North Bristol because there won't be enough parking at the arena at Filton. And the traffic chaos that we will have in the day from people getting to work from the new homes in South Gloucestershire will then be compounded by the traffic chaos at night by people going to the arena. So actually, it doesn't work for anybody. And if you happen, whether you live in Avonmouth or whether you live in Hartcliffe, if you do want to go to the arena, the transport arrangements for getting to Filton will be frightening. It'll probably be quicker to get to the O2.
Now, it's only fair to give Marvin Rees, the Mayor, a say on this. He's told me quite a number of times his office have said that he's too busy to come on this programme, even though the last time he was here, he was actually sitting outside in the Eastern Community Centre here waiting for a meeting, and he still couldn't pop in to answer any questions. But anyway, so he had this to say at the extraordinary meeting on Monday where this was being discussed.
We've been making the point repeatedly, it's for the whole city, not just for a narrow slither of the city that is best positioned to take advantage of the next raft of opportunity that comes along, which has been a problem of the city's past. But let me just address a few key points. I won't make too many. We'll raise some at the end. Firstly, you know, I respect people who have views about the arena, and I respect the fact when they're different to you know, they disagree with where I might come down. But it won't have escaped anyone's attention that some of the quality of that debate has been quite low. If people want to express a reasoned position, that's fine. But when people start to engage in slurs and accusations, unwelcome activity in the city, that's really not acceptable when there's no evidence. And unfortunately, it's not just in the in the usual places that might have happened. It's actually come into this chamber as well. So there's been no impropriety by me or any council officer. Everything we've done has been within best practice in the best interest of the city. Making allegations of doing favours or receiving a financial reward doesn't help the argument. And the argument around the purity of the democratic process, one of the things that must happen in a democratic process is that actually we look at evidence and we look at facts. We look at the research. We have a clear criteria against which to make our decision. And it seems to me that we've had a number of waves to this campaign. One has been to try and make the case on the location of the arena. Secondly, is to begin to make statements about my character. The third has been then to move into local council bureaucracy. And I guess there's another one coming, because I think things like that come in fours. So bring your arguments, but just keep them based on the evidence.
Right, so the most frustrating thing, Marvin says there, that it be based on the evidence. Scrutiny presented Marvin with a whole list of questions. He didn't, by the way, come to our scrutiny meeting either, so it's not just you that he hasn't got time to visit. He hasn't answered those questions. So we can't make comparison on the evidence because he won't provide it. So if I give you one example of the questions we asked, the calculations for the benefits of an arena at Filton have made the assumption that 25% of the financial benefit goes to South Gloucestershire. We asked the question, why 25%? Can we have an explanation of that? Because the location and the access to the to the arena are such that we believe that leakage will be significantly higher. Make it significantly higher, and the benefit from that arena is very much reduced.
So why hasn't, if he's got this evidence, why hasn't Marvin published it?
I have no idea. All the evidence that we have had has been for this cabinet meeting was published at the latest possible moment before the cabinet papers could be produced, so that there was the minimum amount of time for backbench councillors to actually understand, ask questions, and get responses. So this is the frustration, that it's been designed in such a way to avoid openness, to avoid transparency, and to bring about the decision that the mayor had been first talking of some 15 or 16 months ago, unbeknown to us.
They're a private contractor. Surely that's necessary with commercial confidentiality.
Oh, except there's a need for confidentiality, and one shouldn't want to do anything that would put the city council at risk. But the fact is that if you are going to involve members in a scrutiny process, which is a requirement of local government anyway, you should do so in such a way that that information can be made available, made accessible, and then respond to questions. Otherwise, members can't actually play any constructive part in the process.
Liz Lation, you're from Glastonbury Street, from Somerset County Council. Looks like the arena's moved even further away from your constituents.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about that, because I'm not hearing anyone talking about the need for it. And as a former arts promoter, the first thing the Arts Council used to ram down your throat was prove the need. So I'm hearing loads of people talking about a building, huge amounts of money, whopping great infrastructure. I'm not hearing anyone talk about percentage of sales at the Cardiff Arena or at O2, what might go in it, what the programme might be, who the audience might be, where they might travel from. If I was any part of that scrutiny, my list of questions would be endless, but they wouldn't be about roads, although I take the point about the council paying for road infrastructure that increases the value of the asset. Normally with the developer, it's the other way round. The developer pays for the roads and the under section 106 or whatever. That seems bonkers to me. But I'm not hearing anyone talk about what's going in the arena, who would come. Prove the need to me. Tell me who the audience is. Look 5 and 10 years ahead. Will that same audience have enough money for massive ticket prices?
If I can just answer that, I mean, the papers that have been put forward detail all of that. They indicate the demand. They show the fact that Bristol is the only major city in the UK without an arena. They show the type of people. They show the catchment area that it will come from, including the whole of the South West. And they talk about the impact of arenas based in Cardiff and Birmingham as well. So all of that is analysed in great detail. One of the main debates has been about the size of the arena between the 12,000-seater at Temple Meads and the 16,000 at Felton. So actually, a lot of discussion has gone on about that. A lot of questions have been asked about it. We've had experts giving us their opinion and showing us how the figures were arrived at. The frustration is that the Temple Meads figures were done in very, very great detail for all the proposals that were put forward. The Felton figures appear to have been submitted as a very rough calculation of what might happen without any detailed work in support. So we have different levels, and that was part of the problem. The report that KPMG did on value for money of all the different projects, one project which is virtually shovel ready and ready to go has had very detailed analysis. Both the others, KPMG caveat by saying we've only looked at the figures prepared by either YTL or the City Council, and we've only looked at the headline, we haven't checked the detail. So they've been paid to give an opinion which they then qualify. So there are questions about how valuable that information actually is.
Well, Marvin, the Mayor, had quite a lot of things more to say about this. Let's have a listen to in the next little section from his introduction to the meeting on Monday evening.
Secondly, you know, it's really important to recognise that the decision over the location of the arena is not a like-for-like comparison. It's not a Lego block that we put in one place or the other. Each decision has very different financial consequences and risk for this authority, and I would say, by extension, the city. And unless you address the very real financial differences between those options, you're not addressing the fullness of the decision we have to make as an authority. We've been clear that there needs to be a criteria for success. I appreciate the point about happiness and well-being. I worked in public mental health. We want well-being. We want resilience. But people achieve well-being through having homes, good quality jobs, an inclusive economy, and as we look at our tax base for the future, making sure that we can fund the public services, many people in this chamber will be outraged central government have been cutting. We have to look at this question, as was raised earlier on, is what is the level of risk we're prepared to expose this authority to? That is all tied up in the decision we have to make tomorrow.
So my challenge to Marvin is, what is the level of risk to Broadmead, to Cabot Circus, to jobs in the centre of Bristol? And the Value for Money report has not taken any account of that. I believe with the pressure on the retail sector at the moment, if you walk around Broadmead now and see the number of empty shops in the galleries and in those roads, the viability of that area is on a knife edge. The message that will be given by saying we're not going to start an arena that could be in place within 2 to 3 years. What we're going to do is go through the planning processes for a mixed-use development at Temple Meads and an arena at Felton. Both of those are 5 to 9 years away. And in that time, Bristol City Centre could deteriorate very significantly. That, to me, is the biggest risk, and he's refusing to even acknowledge that that exists.
I'm still confused. If young people don't have enough money to spend and therefore the high street's going down the pan, I take the points about online shopping. If there isn't enough money to go round for shopping, where's the money coming from for the tickets for all of these shows at the arena? It might be that Bristol's missed the boat. They might just be 10 years behind.
There's always that possibility, but it's very interesting that the people who were prepared to run the Arena Island, Temple Meads Arena, are some of the biggest promoters in the country. They strangely have no problem selling tickets for various events between 10,000 and 50,000 attending. They have every confidence that they continue to do so. And to be honest, you look at the figures for arenas around the country, and as long as they're city centre ones, they're prospering and going to continue to prosper. And I just make the point, this isn't a party political issue, in that the Lib Dems in Bristol, the Greens in Bristol, all share that view about a Temple Meads arena.
Okay, so, well, the decision's made, and in fact, in a way, the decision's been put off, hasn't it, for another 3 or 4 years, until anything's going to be starting to be built. So I guess we'll be revisiting this again.
Well, Tony, just say that the only decision that's been made so far is that Marvin has decided that there won't be an arena in Temple Meads. The planning law is such that he can't decide there will be an arena at Felton until he's got something else already moving on the Temple Meads site. Otherwise, it will fail the sequential planning test, which was one of the subjects of the Freedom of Information exchanges, which proved Bristol City Council officers who are responsible for the planning process advising YTL on how to avoid the sequential planning test.
I suppose the long and short of this, Martin Summers, is that the way that this has been carried out has really been all behind closed doors, very, very little, and only revealing things to people like Jeff and the other councillors that we elect at the very last minute.
Well, that's a fundamental problem with the mayoral system. It creates a division of powers. If there isn't a division of powers, the mayor can decide. That's what the rules say. I must say, I have some sympathy with what Liz is saying. Maybe under the conditions we're in, we just have to cancel the whole thing. Maybe they're both white elephants. If there's a crash, nobody would be going to anything anyway.
Interesting way to finish. But anyway, so Brexit, we've got to talk Brexit, because we've had one of my favourite people, King Mervyn, I used to call him. He's the former Bank of England governor, and he had a few things to say about Brexit this week, which didn't get anywhere near as much coverage as I hoped they would have, because I think he's quite a wise old bird when it comes to Britain's total lack of preparation for the severing of the links to Brussels.
If as a country we cannot take a big decision about whether or not we should be in the European Union, which is based on sovereignty, it's based on controlling our borders. There are arguments on both sides. We ought to be able to have a reasonable and civilized debate on that and then have a vote. What we're now getting is not a reasonable or civilized discussion. It's a discussion where both sides seem to be throwing insults at each other. And I find that deeply depressing. And frankly, if a government cannot take action to prevent some of these catastrophic outcomes, whatever position you take on the EU, it illustrates a whole lack of preparation. It doesn't tell us anything about whether the policy of staying in the EU is good or bad. It tells us everything about the incompetence of the preparation for it.
So this government has been incompetent?
The group of people tasked with trying to make decisions on all this, Parliament as a whole, not just the government and the civil service, have brought us to a position where we're now being told that we have to accept a certain course of action because otherwise it will be catastrophic. Now, it beggars belief that the sixth biggest economy in the world should get itself into that position. Everyone in Europe has a strong economic incentive in coming to a free trade agreement. That is something we should have said in 2016. Was what we wanted to do. But the only way to get other countries to agree to that is to demonstrate that we'd actually put in place credible plans to be prepared to leave without a deal, because we can't impose a deal on anyone else. You've got to have a credible bargaining position. We haven't had a credible bargaining position because we haven't put in place measures where we could say to our colleagues in Europe, look, you know, we'd like a free trade deal. We think that you would probably like one too. But if we can't agree, don't be under any misapprehension. We have put in place the measures that would enable us to leave without one. And that is a practical thing that can be done. It can't be done in 6 months. It takes several years. But you have to start straight away.
We've got 6 months. What should we do now?
I'm not going to tell the government what it should do. But what it is pretty clear is that we are likely to have some sort of deal. But we're going to get the worst of both worlds. We will leave next March, but only in the sense that we won't be going to any of the meetings that take decisions, so we'll have no say in what happens, and yet we'll still be bound by all the rules and regulations of the European Union. And I think the biggest risk to the UK, and this is what worries me most, is that this issue isn't going to go away. You know, the referendum hasn't decided it, because both camps feel that they haven't got what they wanted. And that is not how policy in Britain is normally made. Normally you have an issue, both sides present their case, you have a general election, the government that wins puts its policy in place, we accept it. What we've now got is a situation where I think neither side are accepting where we are.
Interesting point of view there from the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King, speaking on the World Service this week. Now, Jeff, he's talking about doom and gloom. He's using the word incompetent to describe Theresa May and the Conservative government's approach, really saying that they should have been prepared from day one for a no deal and used that as a bargaining chip, but they simply haven't done that.
Well, first of all, Tony, I must say I'm really welcoming your support for former members of the establishment, because I've been coming to this programme for a good few years and I don't remember you being quite so complimentary about Mervyn King in the past. In fairness, he wasn't saying it was just the government that were incompetent. He was basically saying everybody in the House of Commons was, and most of the civil service were. And to be honest, I can't really disagree with that. I think that the Prime Minister has an impossible job to negotiate the most complex exit deal imaginable in public is actually a nigh on impossible job. I'm not convinced that certain members of the Cabinet hadn't decided that if they did nothing, we would end up with a very hard Brexit, which is what they wanted. They're no longer in the Cabinet, so that at least means that there may be now slightly more possibility of a satisfactory solution. But he's right. They have got to get their act together and sort this out quick, because the country needs a calm and proper exit if that's unfortunately what's got to happen.
Liz, is it going to be a disaster, Brexit, do you think? Are Lib Dems rubbing their hands saying, told you so?
They're not rubbing their hands, I can assure you of that. They're really worried for the country. I would say if it looks impossible, that may be because it is impossible. If it looks very difficult, it probably is very difficult.
Doesn't it mean World Trade Organisation rules? That's
no,
where we're going to go with a no deal, isn't it?
I think it looks really worrying. If it takes 40 years to put something together to get to this stage, why does anyone think you can take that apart and put it back together another way in 2 years? Of course you can't. It's impossible, in my opinion.
I mean, marriages are easy, divorce is not so easy. Isn't that just what we're dealing with?
Yeah, and divorce takes time and costs money. And, you know, I mean, maybe something will happen that is not to my choice and not to my taste. And in 20 years' time, people will look back and say, well, she was a fool, wasn't she? Actually, we're better off now. But in the short term, if you were going to choose a time to do something in the national interest that took ages and cost a fortune and diverted civil servants and politicians from what matters in local authority, for one thing, and in the... This is not the time to do it.
Well, one person who would totally agree with you, and I bet you wish he wouldn't, is the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair. And he's been on the TV and the radio today talking about, really, about how incompetently, at least as he sees it, Jeremy Corbyn has been dealing with this and other problems. So let's have a little listen to Tony Blair now.
We can all agree on that.
Yeah, I will be committed to seeing a Labour government elected. And if Jeremy Corbyn is the leader, he is elected as the Prime Minister. However, right, I want to put a qualification down. It is going to be extremely difficult, in my view, for Labour to deliver on its promises if it puts itself in exactly the same position as the Tory government are going to be on Brexit. Because it will find that it has less money to deal with the country's problems, that it's distracted by dealing with Brexit rather than dealing with the health service and jobs and living standards and so on, and that therefore, in my view, if you end up, and I've said this before, if you end up in a situation where you do Brexit and then have a Corbyn government, this country's going to face a very, very challenging situation.
Well, hot off the blocks, Jeremy Corbyn within seconds was on TV responding to Tony Blair.
I think Tony should recognise that party membership is now much bigger than it's ever been. It's the biggest it's ever been in my lifetime, well over 500,000 members. And in the general election last year, we set out what our aspirations are for the people of this country. Aspirations of eliminating homelessness. Aspirations of putting more money and resources into education through a national education service, ending university fees, building 500,000 council homes, taking water into public ownership, overwhelmingly popular policies. And we got, sadly we didn't win it, but we got the highest vote for Labour since 2001. So I just think we need to recognise people are not prepared any longer to live in a society that's so unequal and walk by on the other side while some of our fellow citizens are sleeping on the streets. We have to invest in our future and invest in our public services. And that's what the fundamental Labour message was in the general election.
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn made my points for me, so I'll pass
the ball on. Liz, Lib Dems?
My only comment is that it's funny how former prime ministers make more sense when they're former rather than when they are prime ministers. I'm no fan of Blair, I'm afraid.
Why do you think he's so pro-EU and anti-Brexit?
Because that's what he is. That's what he is. I think this is something that actually comes down to people's instinctive feels, and okay. I think they go
Jeff,
one way or
finally,
the other.
Jeff, what do you make of Blair and his intervention really criticising Corbyn?
Well, actually, it's what I make of Mr. Corbyn, because in his response to Tony Blair, there was a mention of all sorts of wonderful policies that we'd all like to see, but no mention of Brexit and what the Labour Party stance is. And actually, they've been much happier having a debate about anti-Semitism than they have about Brexit, which is a disaster for the country.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Lib Dem Councillor for Glastonbury and Street, Liz Leishan, Mayor Ferguson's Finance Chief, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim, and Henley's Jeff Gollop, also Martin Summers. Join us after the news.
On your mobile.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.